off then. A hemp land normally is more fertile than the high land. Now they tell me, and I believe it, I've tried it, you can grow corn on hemp land and it'll be harder. And the weevils won't eat as bad as it does is growing on pine land. But the way they grow corn nowadays, they grow it so fast and fertilize so heavy, it's so soft. If you don't treat it, the weevils will eat it up quick.
You don't have a hard variety?
Yeah. No, I said, we used to, there's several hard varieties. Cuban Flint, but it was a harder horse than our lead. And there was a disadvantage there.
Yeah.
They had almost. Some of it would be weevil eating and some of it wouldn't. You can take and seal your barn and then they got stuff that'll kill the weevil. You claim you can back your car up and put a hose over your exhaust and run it in there and run your motor for a while.
But you all never treated corn.
No, we never treated.
You didn't know that then.
No.
But they grew it on the hemp land, which kept that seemed like the weevils didn't bother it as bad, and the corn they grew on the pine land, they fed that up first and saved the hemp corn land, which made the.
And you sealed your cribs.
I said you could do. No, we never did. You used to make corn cribs out of log poles, barn.
Yeah.
And they'd be cracks that big. And try to always get them small enough where the corn wouldn't go through it.
Yeah.
Have a wooden floor, and then the gables, a lot of times the gables would be left open.
Well, that made it good on the squirrels.
Oh, yeah. Squirrels could go in there and get it.
But now, I don't remember many squirrels ever going in the barn years back, do you?
No. But here in the last 4 or 5 years, they eat a lot of my corn, and I eat a lot of them. And there's nothing better. You take a young squirrel and let him eat corn until he gets fat, and that is good. I'd rather have a fried chicken any time.
What, do you shoot him with a rifle?
I have done, but I can't see to shoot a rifle anymore.
Yeah.
Use a shotgun, a light shot, light load.
Well, if you get one of those lenses, those
scopes, I might could do that, but I never have been a scope man. I just love to throw up the gun and shoot.
Yeah.
It takes a little time, and I don't think a scope's any good for moving game. Unless you're a whole lot better than I am.
Yeah.
But you've got to get it up and get those crossheads, you know, right on your target.
Sure.
And a moving target, you have to keep moving that scope to get your crosshead right.
Yeah. Well, now, sometimes they make them so you can use your ordinary sights underneath the scope.
Yeah.
But I never was able to do that.
But most of them got that little crosshead in there, you know.
Yeah.
Got to get that lined up with your back into your scope. And,
when you shoot with a rifle, do you aim it, really?
Yeah.
You don't just point it?
No. You have a front and back sight, you know.
It had a double porch.
Front porch, and it was originally called a cypress shingle.
Yeah.
The house was built by the old man J.C. Faulkner, Mrs. Rosenberger's father.
I asked him if they knew the Rosenberger and said no.
Now, he's the one that's a doctor who...
He wanted to be a doctor, and he always studied medical books, and he was...
Well, now, one of those was in here, Rosenberger. Wasn't he the one? Who else? Who was the doctor who came in and...
Roseboro. Gene Rosenberger was our postman out here. About what year?
I see.
In the 1930s, I guess.
He was
somewhere about there.
I believe he is a Republican.
Now, your house, now let me see. The ordinary thing was for these would be the bedrooms, wouldn't they? Upstairs.
Yeah.
And then you have a bedroom. Would you have a living room and a parlor downstairs? How would that be?
This was considered both, I think.
You mean this house?
Yeah.
Well, years back, we always called this the parlor.
Mm-hmm. Well, where was the living room?
Well, we call it living room now, but back...
Well, now, the parlor we had, we didn't sit in it. We sat in the living room and kept the parlor company.
Well, now, that was the way with my two grandmothers. But they had more rooms in their home than we had in ours. But my grandmother Smith had what she called the parlor and the sitting room.
Now this this wing part of it here could be double deck, but it wouldn't necessarily.
No.
And that'd be your dining room, your kitchen, and pantry and all like that.
We launched out even drew plans one time to take the top story off of this house, and I got to thinking about it. It'd be so much, such a little bit of lumber that you could salvage. Square top bungalow. Just got it in the talking stage and it never did go any further.
Well, I'm glad
he didn't. But I thought it was in his mind.
To get rid of the upstairs. That was the general idea. I've always wanted me a modern home right down on the ground where you don't have to go up steps, you know. I think they're a whole lot more convenient. Have your carport where you can go from the house and get in your car without having to walk 100 yards. And if it's raining or real cold or anything, you can go get in your car.
How long you had that idea?
I don't know, but I still think it'd be a good thing. You take...
Well, now, people never did have that idea until just recently.
I know. But you take an elderly person, if they want to go out to get in the car, they got to go down those old high steps.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we put that railing up there.
Sure.
We call it old folks railing.
Sure.
And I think it would just be so much more convenient. Now, like you got it, I like that idea too.
Yeah, but I didn't plan that.
No. And maybe it takes an afflicted person to think out these things.
Maybe so.
But our old back steps out there, they are high too.
Yeah.
And if you come in with a load, we must always bring our groceries to the house.
Yeah.
But it'd be so much more convenient if you just walk up, maybe step up one step. And going in the door and going back in your house.
Well, this is a little unusual where you don't have any access to the back of the house.
Yeah.
Everything else, all your traffic is right in front.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, they couldn't go back there because there's a swamp back there. And so far as building a road is concerned.
Yeah.
It'd take lots and lots of work.
But we never did bring anything around the back of the house, unless it was something real heavy that you could come around with. But we've always brought the groceries and things from out front. I never forget, my daddy was going to town one day with a bucket of eggs, and it was just a kind of a hard dirt walk out there, and some way he stumbled. Down he went with a whole bucket of eggs. And I think nearly every one of them were broken. You know, we used to raise chickens,
yeah.
And you would take your eggs to the store more than you could use at home.
There was a man Bolton right up here. He had enough chickens to he'd make more syrup than he used. And Saturday he'd go to town and he'd take eggs enough and syrup enough and sell them or trade them and get his groceries.
Sure.
Which he didn't have to buy very many, because later years wasn't anyone there but he and his wife. And when he died, he had a lot of receipts where they still owe him for eggs. He had more than he'd take up getting his groceries.
Yes.
And, well, I believe he did have an automobile today. I mean, he had a horse and buggy. Did they ever have lights up there before he died?
Oh, no.
He had a telephone, one of his old party line telephone.
We didn't get lights out here until about 1947, I believe, we finally got our EA out here. We kept working on it for 2 or 3 years before we ever got it. And like I told you the other night, Mr. Bruce Boyles wired our house and all the houses around in this vicinity.
This is wiring?
Of course, we've had some done since then, but he did the first wiring that was done in this house.
Well, now, they came to this country in around 1940.
Well, it was in, I would think, about 1947 or maybe 46 that he wired the house, because he wired it before we ever got the electricity in here.
And they had a spiel. If you'd have your house wired, that'd be an inducement to get them to run the line on out here.
Well, that's what
we fell for. I was planning up there, and if he would come by and talk to me about it, and I said, well, I reckon eventually we're going to get them anyhow, and might as well go on. He asked me what I wanted, and not thinking, I just threw him a light in the rooms, and one in the hall, and the kitchen and dining room. Well, I didn't have any out of them. We'd get a refrigerator and a freezer and an electric stove and a hot water heater and all that. But finally I told him, and he made me a price of $150, I think it was.
No, it was $75.
And
then when he come down here and was going to do the wiring, I told him I wanted the wiring done different from what he had talked to Tuck. And he said it would be $100.
I told him.
How'd you want it?
Well, I wanted receptacles and things in the house. Chuck didn't think about that. And, of course, I didn't have enough put in at the time. And since then, we've had Hilton Heron to do extra wiring and Bobby Sutton to do extra wiring.
Uh-huh. You got to have a place where you run 220 to your stove, you know.
Yeah. Well, now, have you all had modern taste all the way on along?
I don't know just what you call modern taste.
We kind of
lived as the times went, I reckon you'd call it.
Yeah.
Not too much. We just added as we could afford it. A few extra comforts. I've often thought about how much my daddy would have enjoyed electricity, because during his lifetime, see, we didn't have it out here.
Yeah.
Brought our ice out from Micanopy, old colored man that worked for Mr. Jones, that was the old T&J Depot agent. And this colored man's name was Bugman, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he drove the ice truck for Mr. Jones for years and years. Well, that was the way we'd get ice, you know, with the old refrigerator. And then later we bought a more modern refrigerator, and the ice was brought out from Gainesville in the middle.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And at first, old man Jones had a little house built there, and he put a lot of sawdust in. And they'd ship ice down to Micanopy on an old T&J train in 200 or 300 pound cakes. They'd put it out there in that house, and I don't think he delivered much back then, but you'd go there, you'd go out there and saw you a piece of ice.
Go get ice, make homemade ice cream. That was something we did real often then.
Yes, yeah.
But we don't anymore.
And then it's a whole lot better than a stove by
Yeah.
Cream too. Get your good rich cow milk. And have your fresh eggs. And I always like peach ice cream. Hey, goodness.
With fresh peaches.
Yeah.
Yeah. And plenty of cream. It wasn't just whole milk. And I don't think they use milk on this ice cream we buy anymore.
I don't either.
It's
like new sausage. You call them pork sausage. If you're going by majority of what to put in there, ought to be cereal sausage. I just got some from Ms. Myers out there. And she's supposed to, she makes them herself and seasons. And she used the right kind of seasoning, to my way of thinking. But they get these Boston butts, and most of them are frozen. And you cannot make good sausage out of frozen meat. Now, I don't care. You can make the sausage good, but you can't make it taste good.
Yeah.
B. Rogers and me tried that, and we got a whole bunch of them one time. And I told him, I said, you can get them fresh, you know. And I told him, I said, don't put those things in the freezer. And he forgot to tell the old nigger, and he went and put them in the freezer. Then we had to take them out and let them thaw out before we could start making the sausage. I never did like it.
Well, now, Beatty Rogers is, he works with meat all the time, still does, yeah. Doesn't he?
Yeah. Oh, he gets his, no, he doesn't get his beef cut up, but he gets used mostly loin for his steaks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
He used to raise his own chickens, but I think he's quit that now. Mm-hmm. And pork, he gets it somewhat cut up, you know, hams and shoulders. And I went down there not too long ago, and he said, you want me to tell you something? I said, yeah, what is it? He's always telling some kind of an unbelievable story.
Oh, he is?
And kid funny, you know. You don't mean it. And he says, I bought some backbone and spare ribs the other day and some hams. And he said the backbone and spare ribs was a dime a pound higher than a ham. I was with people who are foolish to buy it, because when you buy backbone and spare ribs, you buy more bone than anything else. And I can't figure out why they would, but I've seen it advertised in the paper, so he was right about it. 10 cents a pound more for spare ribs and backbone than for ham. Well, there's very little waste about a ham, you know. It does have a bone in it, and then you have your hock, but you take those hocks and boil with them, and it seasons your vegetables. So other than what little bone there is in a ham, I don't believe there's a tenth as much waste as it would be in spare ribs and backbone.
What? How do you explain that?
People just go for backbone and spare ribs.
And willing to pay?
Willing to pay the difference, yeah.
Well, they barbecue for me in the spare ribs.
These old neck bones we buy nowadays, they used to throw those away in the market.
Yeah.
And like you can take them and boil them up and put a little seasoning in them and a little butter or something to make it edible and make your rice and rich rice and you can eat them just dry, so if you mind it, but you'd almost starve to death before you got enough meat off of the bone. There's very little meat on those bones. They see they trim that and make hamburger. Beef and trim pork bones and make sausage and whatnot. The old fellow said when he butchered, he didn't throw away nothing but the squeal of a hog, so that's about the way you can figure that out again.
Yeah. How much sausage did you put up?
I don't remember you this year. I tried to buy some calves, and I was inquiring around about a hog, and he said he had one he let me have, and he brought it over here, and I guess I made 125 and 150 pounds of sausage. But I used the whole hog. Every bit of meat I could cut off except the... Well, he had to cut some lard out of it, you know, some was too fat in the bone, but I used hams and shoulders and loin.
For sausage?
Mm-hmm. And you get this old, this seasoning, it's called old plantation seasoning. And you weigh your meat out and it comes in, would you say a half a pound package?
I think it's a fourth of a pound.
Anyhow, you put a package of that to 25 pounds of meat. And I learned something here 2 or 3 years back. We used to grind our meat and then put the seasoning in and get in there with your hand and throw it around and mix it all up. And I was down there and beat it one time making sausage. He, our one, suggested that we... See, he's got a big old meat block back there. You could put 40 or 50 pounds of meat on it. Well, we'd weigh up 25 pounds of meat and put it on there and sprinkle out seasoning all over it, then mix it up a little bit, then run it through your mill, and you really got about as true a mixture as you can get.
Now, how is that? I missed that. You mean you put seasoning salt on before you make it, before you grind it?
You had to cut your meat up in little blocks or strips for it to go through your mill.
Yeah, with a knife.
Yeah, and then you put it in the mill with that seasoning on it, and it's grinded, it just naturally mixes good.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how did you do it, used to do it? How did you see how you mix your seasoning in it?
It ground it and then mix the seasoning in it.
With your hands?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just take a big tin tub, put the meat in there, and then sprinkle your seasoning around, and get in there and stir and stir and stir. Mm-hmm. And when it's cool, well, your hands get cool.
Well, now, that was a lot of stirring, wasn't it?
Yeah. But you can
too.
Do it so much easier the other way, you know. But I got an old pound mill out there that it works pretty good. But I would, if I had a new mill, I don't believe I'd do that unless I thoroughly cleaned it out, because that salt in there, those mills are made out of cast or steel or something, and it rusts. Mm-hmm. And it'll make your knives rust, and you know, the little holes that your meat comes through after it's cut up, that'll rust awfully bad if you don't clean it up thoroughly after you get through.
Chuck used to be kind of famous for his salt. He used to have hunters come down and help him with him. And of course, they'd always come in and eat breakfast, and we'd have our sausage. And so they started talking Chuck into making sausage for them. And some of them were down here not too long ago and took us down to see the team, and all the way down and all the way back, they talked every way they could about Chuck's sausage, thinking maybe they could talk him into making some again, but he thought they could.
I said it
with
a hint.
But he used to, about how many pounds would you make up at the time of fall?
I made a high of 200 pounds. Then most of them, you know, they wanted stuff then smoked. That's the mole work. And way back, the women folks used to make the casings out the hog entrails, the small ones.
Well, that was way back, too.
And that was work. Back them times, the men folks, they'd kill the hogs, scald them and scrape the hair off and open them up and then cut up the meat. Well, the time they got them opened up, there's 3 or 4 women that they'd take those chitlins and entrails or whatever you want to call them and go to scraping them. And by the time you got your sausage mill and all, and back them times you had a little old, you've seen these little old sausage mills with a crank on them. And that was some good exercise when you had to grind 100 pounds of meat.
Yeah. But now, how did he do that? Just invite a lot of pet fellas out to eat sausage?
No, it's
well,
honest.
Come out and hunt with him.
Yes.
Go duck hunting with him. That was years back when everything was open in here and wasn't fenced up. And there was a fellow by the name of Mark Boston from Jacksonville. His family lived around Micanopy, and He went to school with my brother, and I don't know how Tuck met him, but anyway, they got to be real good friends, and he'd come down and hunt with Tuck and bring some friends with him.
Did you ever know Frank Keep Boardman?
Yes.
He was Mrs. Bonson's brother.
Oh.
And they were Keeps.
No, Tuck, you're wrong with that.
Well,
Frank Keep's mother was Mark Bonson's sister.
Well, why did Bubba call Frank uncle?
Frank Keep and Mark were first cousins.
Well, I'm not much.
Frank Keep's mother was Lena Funk.
Yeah. And she married Keep?
She married Frank Keep. And he was, the Frank Keith that was down at McIntosh, the young Frank Keith, and Mark Bolson were first cousins.
Well, I'm almost sure Mark Jr. called him uncle.
Well, he might have, but that would have been wrong.
Mark was the safety director in Jacksonville. And he was just on the payroll. He's smart and highly educated. He'd bring some of the well-offs down here, and we'd go hunting and get to the lake, and he'd bet them that we'd get the limit. The limit back then was 10 ducks per hunter. And then he'd bet them $10 or $15 that we'd be high man. Well, back in those days, we hunted in little old tiny push boats. It wasn't hardly big enough for one man safe. And he and I would go in and double.
He a big man too?
No, he was a small man, but I'd sit down in the back of the boat. It was, had sharp end in front and back. And you had to be pretty good to push it not to tip over. And we hunted on Wednesdays. What they call sneak shooting. You'd get a good hard wind today. When the prairie is down, sometime the grass would be about that high, but there'd be holes around it. The ducks fed in. And I'd stand up and see where they were feeding and sit back down and had to push against the wind all the time, naturally. And I'd push up there, and sometimes both of us shoot. Sometimes, if it wasn't necessary, he'd just shoot. And we never lost a bet. After he made these bets, he said, "Now, if you help me get these ducks, says, if I win, you can have the money." And he always furnished most of the ammunition. So it was a pretty good deal for me, but it was work.
You had to push the...
Yeah, I was the motor.
Well, now, you, did you go out before dawn?
Yeah, wasn't no time limit on when you start and when you stop.
Yeah.
And we had shot ducks out that twilight. It was just, I'll say it's more or less luck than good shooting if you kill one. But they'd come in there just fast as they could fly almost, and you'd take a pot shot at it.
Well, you didn't go out there on an empty stomach.
Hmm?
No, he cooked breakfast for them.
Yeah, that's where they got to start eating the sausage.
Chuck would get up and always cook breakfast for him. He'd get up sometimes 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, really?
I've got
cook grits and sausage, and I never did make very many biscuits back then because the light bread come in, and they didn't know nothing about good biscuits. Nobody.
Yeah.
And make coffee. We had drove the same B. Rogers and me down in, I guess it's Lever County, about 25 miles below, I figured it's 40, 45 miles to a little, they call it a lake, I call it a swamp, Cypress Swamp. Man, there was ducks in there by the thousand. Called it Deer Lake, it wasn't nothing but a Cypress Swamp. And it was hard hunting. I mean, those ducks would come in and dip down those little holes, and you had to be quick on the trigger if you got one. We'd get up way before daylight and drive down there and hunt and then come back.
Yeah. You mean you just take a hunt a little while and come on back?
Yeah. I would come to Williston and get dinner and put what Duffy had on Cold Store and go back that afternoon. So we've been to Meadows Prairie over there this side of Fort McCoy. Get up and go there and hunt. And then we found a place out from Williston. We call it. I can't think of no name now.
Was it Stafford Lake?
Stafford Lake. And then I get confused. It's over here on this McIntosh Road. This is what they call a Stagger's Prairie over there. But this is Stafford Lake down there. And first two or three times we went hunting down there, there was a lake and probably had 15 acres in it. And they had a lot of water, a lot of rain. And if it had as much rain down as we have, I guess the same way. You could get in a boat and go for miles and miles. It was prairie, and in dry time, the cattlemen used it for a pasture. But when it filled up with water, there's some kind of, I don't know what you call it, moss or weed that I've never seen in any other lake around where I've been hunting. And the ducks feed on it. And there's lots of ducks down there. Now, I remember one place out there, a cattleman had a salt box. And it was, I guess, 6.5 to 7 feet high. And the water was right up to the tip top of that thing. He had it covered. But, Lord, if there's any salt in there when it's still up, it nicely melted and went on, you know. We got right in there behind that thing. And there was islands, tree islands all around. And you could flip around and deal, you didn't have to have anything back of you because it's all hammock thick, you know. Leave your little blind out in front of your boat. Put your decoys out there and those ducks would come in there and see them. And I really enjoyed hunting down there. And we didn't have to do no pushing. We had these little old motors. Just slip your boat in and get in and go where you wanted to.
What kind of blind did you rig up?
If you get long dog films or palmetto fawns, started to tell you about Mark and me. One time he come down and he had up a bit, and we got over the limit that day. We killed 49 ducks, and I tried my best to get the other, but I never was able to. I was going to have it said we could kill. Did they have any game wardens back then?
Yes, they had a few, but they never checked anything.
Mm-hmm. They never did. We didn't think nothing about it, because there's more ducks than everybody could kill. So.
There were just thousands and thousands of them in those days. They'd fly over the house, and you could just hear them flying, you know, in droves.
And this boy up here in the last few years, he'd get out there at dusk, and they'd fly over, and he'd kill him one or two.
Just flying over?
Yeah, just flying over.
Well, I can remember my brother killing them flying over when we first moved out here. To be so thick and so many of them and so low. Well, I can remember him killing a few like that.
Well, now, I thought you had all the ducks right around here that you could shoot.
Well, in some years you have a lot of them, and other years you don't. It depends on how much water you got. It looks like it. The more water you have, the more ducks you have, but it's not true. Because if we got lots of water here, they got lots of water so many other places, till they don't come to this particular lake.
Well, there wasn't too many people duck hunting back at the time that you and Mark used to hunt like that.
No.
But now, most everyone duck hunts.
And he was the one who started me a wing shooting. Oh. I'd slip up to the edge and see some, and I'd shoot them on the water, and then when it got up, I'd shoot again. But we did this sneak shooting a lot, and then late in the afternoon, we'd go where we figured they'd gonna come in to roost and sit there and shoot on the wing.
Well, now, why did you call it sneak shooting?
Because you sneaked up on them. As the nigga said, you snuck up on them. And they'd be sitting there feeding, you know, and with the wind would be blowing right across them, and you'd be going that way, and they couldn't hear you. And if you knew how, you could push those boats where they wouldn't make any racket hardly at all.
And you could actually sneak up on them feeding out
there.
Yeah.
And you rather wing shoot?
Yes, ma'am.
It's more fun.
It's more fun. But
my
it's
father
more,
always
more,
said.
More missing, too.
Yeah, but it's more fun.
I could go out there sometime and seem like it'd be just the easiest thing in the world, you know, to kill them. And you say, well, I know how. You go out there the next time and maybe the ducks would be flying faster or slower. You shoot just like you did the other time and you couldn't cut a feather. You know, we'll forget the first time we shot over decoys. I didn't know anything about it, and the fellows with me didn't. So we went out and made us a little blind, and put our decoys out, and those ducks would come in there just almost fast as they could fly. And they'd see those decoys, and we'd be trying to lead them about 3 feet. And when they'd see those decoys, they'd just put on brakes like that. Well, if you shot 3 feet in front of them, you shot 3 feet in front of them. I don't know how many times we didn't kill a duck. And finally one came in and I didn't see it in time and he hesitated and saw the decoy and then he started firing off slow and accusing. And I said, we're doing the wrong thing. I said, we got to follow these ducks in here and when they hesitate, they want to see those decoys shoot straight at them. Well, if you're shooting 40 yards, you've got a spread of 2.5 or 3 feet of each shot, you see. And that gives you a little advantage, similar to leading one. Those weevil boys, I used to let them come out here and hunt. Had a little camp up there and had a little nigger to do the cooking. He was trying to tell those boys how to shoot ducks. He said, now when you go out there, if they're not firing too fast, he said, you want to lead them an inch. It would be the same thing as shooting straight at them. And he says, but if flying fast, he says, lead them 3 inches. And the boy thought he was right. But we had one nigger here who was the best fisherman, and I reckon the best hunter of anybody I know of. He could go to a pond where you couldn't catch a fish, and he'd catch one of those fish. He was one of this John Barr Watkins' pets. He always went with Barr when he's picking up traps. If he wanted to go fishing, he'd go push the boat. I didn't know of a kicker nowhere in this country outboard motor at that time. You had your good push pole, a large fishing pole, and you'd stand up in the back of that boat and push it wherever you wanted to go.
Well, who was that?
This nigger was named, his name was Wallace John, but they called him Sap.
Sap.
He was a little bitty little old nigger.
Now, he's the one that could fish where there wasn't any fish.
And he could catch fish where you couldn't catch. Not where there wasn't any fish now. And he was smart. You know, they always claim a nigger's dumb.
Yeah.
Well, they are like a fox. He'd go to a pond or a lake, and he'd find him a brim bed. Well, we most always used bonnet worms for fishing. You'd go cut your bonnet with the worm in it, put it in your boat, and then get where you're fishing, and get the worm out and put him on your hook and fish. If he'd find a brim bed, when he took a worm out of a bonnet, he put it back in the boat. I asked him one day, I said, Seth, why do you put your bonnets back in the boat? Is anybody coming along here and see all these bunnies towed out? They'd know there's a brim bed here.
Oh.
He could find a brim. Did you know he could smell them when they're on bed?
No.
I didn't believe it either. And he told me about it. And if the bed near the bunnies, you have to look close, but you'll see those little white roots, bunnet roots, cut up. And when they cut them loose, they come to the top. That's when they're fanning the bed out. And you watch for that. Now, if you have a lot of wind, it'll probably blow all of it away. But you, when they're big, you, if there's a good many fish there, it smells almost like in a fish house. Mm. And you go with the wind, and when you smell them, you keep going there slowly until you get to where you can't smell them, then stop. And they're right there somewhere close.
Now, you learned a lot of things then from Sap.
Yeah, and I've learned a lot of things from other niggas. If you watch it, you take a nigga and give him an axe, if he knows anything at all about it. You watch him and he'll do it the easiest way. Just like you take the most ignorant niggas that we have. They could, way back, you know, they used to chop boxes in pine trees for turpentine. And he had a little old thin blade axe, but it was had a long blade. They'd go to that tree and almost cut a perfect box in. And I tried and I can't do it. I reckon I could after practicing long enough. But they could take a hack and cut a perfect streak on each side of a tree. So you cut one way and one the other. What you call a cat thing. And they hardly ever missed a lick. Because if they did, they'd have to hit another lick. And they were smart.
Now, that is in turpentine.
Yeah.
Now, but you never had any dealings with the turpentine.
Yeah, I worked a little bit. And most I ever did was about passing, cutting them boxes, and they started putting up cups. Mm-hmm. And you'd take 10 or 15 niggas and go out. And
oh, yeah.
One would be cutting streaks, and some would be nailing cups, and you'd tally the cups, and you paid them so much a cup. So much a thousand to put them out.
Oh.
Yeah. I worked at a turpentine steel one day. I was working on the farm. And the nigga, the stiller's helper was sick. And the boss asked me if I'd work down there one day. I told him I didn't know anything about it. Well, they have a platform and then they have runners where you roll that gum up to the top of the steel and pour it in the steel. But I considered myself a pretty good man then. And that thing would just wear me out. You put 8 barrels in the steel at one time. Mm. And I was scuffing with him and the steel would come out. He's a nigger too. And he'd come out there and he said, "Now, you're doing that," but he says, "I can show you the easy way." I'd get my hands almost down to the center of the barrel, you know, pushing it. And he'd put his hand almost to the top and just give it a little punch. Man, he could roll up about 3 times as easy as I was doing it.
Yeah.
And I learned something right there, too.
Now you mean rolling a barrel up the incline?
Yeah. Oh, I guess a barrel of gum will weigh 300 pounds or more. They have a head that they screw in it when you get it full of gum.
Yeah.
And you lay it down, and you know how a barrel is built. You try to push way down on it like that. You push on the whole weight. But if you just push on top, you can get it to roll, and it rolls pretty easy. And then to stand one up, you don't go then just catch a hold of the head, top end of it. You get it to rocking. See on that bell? And when you get it rocking pretty good, then just you up on it pretty good, and it'll stand up. We had a one-legged nigga down there that hole grown out the woods. And I couldn't see how I could do it. Had a peg leg. And man, he rolled up with just these and the rest of them. But Lord, he had arms and muscles as large as the rest of them.
They all pretty well muscled?
Yeah. Well, it's except you now and then a runt, you know. One time, before I started farming for myself, they had a crowd of them out there picking beans, and it wasn't the tiniest little old nigga. I reckon she was a guy called a girl. I don't believe she was that big in their waist. And some of them were talking out there one day, and she told them, she says, "I'm a little piece of leather, but I'm well put together." I'll never forget that. But there were 3 of the best ones that I knew of after I started farming. I've offered to bet people they could stoop over long and they could stand up straight. They'd just get on the row of beans and keep going and going and going.
Yeah.
Hard to ever straighten up. Yeah. Man, I couldn't do it.
Well, let me tell you, I picked cotton.
Yeah.
And I seemed like I got along with cotton pretty well.
Well, that's...
But I never had any experience with beans like I'm down here. Yeah. And you know, I couldn't pick a one basket of them beans. It'd just break my knees. Yeah. I just didn't have the motion, I guess.
I think maybe the third... Maybe it's been given me those beans up there. I had two niggas out here. One of them was named Bessie Lee and the other one named Kitty Martin. And I had the rows 5 acres long, I reckon. And I had these, I was telling you about the other day, Mr. Christian started me off on a Cherokee wax.
Beans. Yes.
And got over to picking the wax. And they come up and I said, all right, y'all better take you two rows apiece. That's about all you can get out. And I said, no, it's going to take more than that. They figured if they get on good rows, they'd have it all the way, you know, because the other's not supposed to get on your row unless you ask them to. So they either had 5 or 7 rows. And I said, you'll never get them out. I said, yes, I will. And they didn't get them out that day, but they picked 39 crates of beans. The two of them. Now that sounds unbelievable. Now Henry Brown said they had one day go there one day and picked 27 by itself. But Lord, they're looking with those things in that bean bush, it just looked like a machine.
I never saw them do it.
If you were tallying and tying up, which later we'd start using tickets, they'll work the devil out of it. You get 25 or 30. And I used to be a big man, I'd try to do it all to keep from having to pay an extra helper. And you'd tie them up in about every 20 rows, you'd make what you call a heap row. And you'd take your wagon or truck and go down and pick them up. So you could straddle one row and you didn't run over your bushes. So I've worked at that thing too. I got enough of beans. And some of them be singing, and all of them, most of them be talking all the time.
I don't know if you saw these pictures of one of his bean fields. I know you did. I don't know.
My son's photographer. He was an aerial photographer in the Navy.
Oh, yeah.
And he married 22 years, I believe. And he said he wouldn't have had maybe but about six, 8 more years. And he got some time off. And he said he had enough of it. And he had been land-based so long until he just decided if he had re-enlisted, he had to be shipped out. He didn't want to go leave his wife. And he, I don't know whether he couldn't or didn't want to take her, one of the two. So he come out.
Now, what's Giger's name?
Lynn. There's two of them.
Yeah.
Lynn and Glenn.
Oh.
And there's four of those boys.
The
old man Giger was married 3 times, I believe.
No, I didn't know there was Lynn and Glenn.
And what was the oldest one name on it?
Wade.
Then there was a young, well, there was 5 of them. Wade and Glenn and Lynn, and the next one was what? No, well, it was a girl, but I mean the youngest boy.
Julian.
There was a younger girl, but this particular day I was going to tell you about it. Well, if I could have turned that off.
I could have turned it off.
Is that then? Lynn give out a chew in the back, and he asked Glenn for a chew. He said, Glenn, do you have any chew in the back? And Glenn says, yeah, I've got a little piece. And he pulled it out, and he had a little square about that big, and he cut it in half and gave him half of it. Lynn says, I chewed up all of mine. And Glenn says, you know, I suppose the church is supposed to suck it. Any unusual thing like that will stick in my mind.
And you can remember right the occasion where the, what all they was doing.
Yeah.
Now, was that in the beans?
In the bean field, yeah.
Yeah.
Lynn was packing, and he'd pack them up, get his crates good and full, and kind of level them off, and then put a top on and wire it down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Glenn and Lynn was doing that. I had an old Studebaker truck, was the roughest thing I was in. And I drove that thing from morning till night.
Mm-hmm.
And time I'd go get the hands, and time we get back, sometime we'd have 50 or more hands in the field. But it didn't take them long to grab off a crate and a half of beans apiece. I have put 100 crates of beans on that old thing and go to market.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, now, in that picture, you look mighty fresh to be working out there in those beans.
I always look my best, regardless of where I
was. That's been quite a few years ago.
How you mean? You mean?
Well, I try to go halfway clean, which is a job on a farm, especially if it's dry and dusty.
Yeah.
And I didn't, when I went to load the truck, it had full forward speed, and I'd put it down in the lowest speed and just straddle it over, and would have it, like I told you a while ago, have a bean stacked on each side of the truck road.
Yeah.
And have one man in the truck and one on each side, and they'd throw them up to him, and he'd stack them in the truck. And all I did was drive. And when it got down to the packing house, they had help there to unload. And I didn't do much but drive.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 1950 to maybe 52 that you did that farm, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. I had a double hernia, and I wasn't supposed to do much anyhow, but it did right on.
But now, you had niggas helping you when you were working in the beans.
Yeah. Not no gathering time. Well, sometime we'd get them to help put out fertilizer. And then later we got distributors
that
you'd work on.
Well, with that crop, I believe Elliot Lee was with you then, and you all used a tractor.
Not when Lynn and me worked together.
All those pictures.
Because I remember plowing beans the first time, and it was cold. And the beans wasn't up as high as it should have been out going along, and he cultivating with a two-row tractor. And I'd cover up one now and then, and he was fussing and going to cover up every one of them. And,
he's suspicious of that two-row tractor.
Yeah. And I tell you, you've got to watch your business when you're doing it.
Yeah.
As slow as they go, they can get out of line the quickest of anything I ever seen. And you've got to hold it right there. If you don't, you're going to cut up or cover up something.
I guess Alex started farming with you regularly. He was helping you along because don't you remember he worked the corn farm after the bean crop?
We planted that same field in sorghum one time. I guess sorghum. We planted with horses and mules, and we didn't get our rows accurate and tried to work it with a tractor, but that wouldn't work. So we had to work it with the horses and mules.
Tell him about what Alex said when he thought Charlie was
going to
have a heart
attack. Had an old long-legged Georgia nigger out there. He was a pretty good worker, but he was a pretty good complainer. And this nigger, Alex, was a scary, superstitious something. One day Charlie said, he was rubbing his chest, and Alex said, Charlie, what's the matter? He says, I got a pain in my chest. He says, you ain't figuring on going out, are you? Charlie says, I don't know. He was scared that nigga was going to die. So him and Charlie wasn't told me about it. And I said, well, Alec, if just you and me was up here and something happened to me, you wouldn't want to leave me with it. He says, Mr. Mack, I'd care the news. He wasn't going to stay. That old horse, he was flying right next to the lake. And I didn't know the old alligator was up there. You've heard an alligator bellow, haven't you?
No.
Well, they can make a roaring sound. And there was one right there close to the lake. This kind of went off deep, and he had him a home out there in the Tussock. And said, come his time to bellow. Well, Eddie didn't know who gave was that. And he bellowed and scared the horse. But I think it scared Eddie worse. He said, I'll still start to leave your horse and plow up there. We caught that same alligator. I reckon it was the same in the same place anyway. And we set a hook for him. Bait a hook and set it. And he got on it and he broke our hook somehow, the first and only hook I ever had one to break. And this Raymond Rollison, him and his wife had a little argument and she shot him in the leg and broke his leg with a pistol. But he had gotten halfway over, he still limped. And we went in two of these little old duck boats. And we went over and we saw that where the gator tore up things around there. So we had what we call a drill rod in cave hunting. You find where the cave is and you keep sticking your drill rod down through there until you touch the old alligator. And you come out and then you shoot him. Well, he drove his boat over and got on that tusk and he kept jugging down through there and he touched him. He had a 22 rifle and I had a long barrel shotgun. And he looked at me and saw, and I could see the tusk when the old alligator wiggled on there, the tusk would kind of move. Finally, he stuck his nose up and he didn't wait long enough. He stuck me, shot him in the nose and didn't kill him. Then he went back on the tusk and we kept working and working. Finally, come over right at me and you could see the tusk and the way he was coming. You know, I was standing up in that little boot and I just put the gun down like that. Now, I didn't wait till he got to the top of the water. But I stunned him, and I reached over and got him by the bill. And Raymond was getting his boot back over, and he come over there. He looked at me and says, that alligator ain't dead. I said, well, you better go to shooting. And so he shot him and killed him. And those little old boats weren't but 10 feet long. And this alligator was 12 feet. So I took everything in my boat, and we loaded the alligator in his boat. And that boat wasn't sticking out the water more than that much. And we had a mile to go. Something was wrong with my old truck. Anyway, I drove a tractor and trailer down there that morning. And I believe that gator would have weighed 500 pounds. And we got to the landing and I said, well, I wouldn't have tried to, I don't believe the boat, but he was a small man. I don't believe it. The boat would have held me and I'd get up, but we got there and I said, now, how are we going to get him in the trailer? Finally, I thought it out. I just got on the tractor and backed the trailer down in the lake, turned the boat over and the gator would practically float. And the tail end was up in the, down in the water a little bit, and we just slid him on up there that way. And come on home, and Art Graham had some niggas down there cutting cross ties. Two or three of them come along, and I had some old sawhorse, and I put me some boards out there. We slid him out the trailer on those boards. That's the way I skinned him. But he was a big alligator.
So that's all that was good, just the skin?
Yeah. So, now, some few people eat the meat. That tail is as pretty a meat as you ever seen.
You didn't eat it?
No. Never tasted the pieces I know of. But a lot of people would eat. They'd eat meat the front legs and the hind legs.
Just went to waste.
Just went to waste.
But Hoyt didn't get in with you on that. He was lumbering most of the time.
Well, he went with Henry Brown and me one time. We was cave hunting over on Leary Lake. And it's hard times then. I mean, sure enough, hard times. We hunted all across the lake. We got two or three. Got over there. We carried a little lunch tied on our back. Sometimes we'd carry a little canteen of water. If we didn't, we'd drink that lake water. And got over there and said, I need our lunch. And Henry says, well, we better get started back. It was about 3 miles, bogging and wading and looking for deer to sign. Henry caught up on that tussock. trying to cut a little step. He's always full of mischief, you know. Oh, I said, look at him. He says, all he's doing that for is to keep from crying. Told him about to give up. And he'd never had an experience hunting like that.
Oh, I'd never had?
No. But that Henry Brown could get across that lake, looked like twice as easy as I could. He's a whole lot lighter. And one experience one year when they were nesting, they'd get to these old sawgrass tussocks, dig up a whole bank, then lay the eggs in. Then they'd dig them a little hole somewhere. And part of the time it was dug up all the way around that thing, and water would be there. And Henry would find one, and he's pretty good at it. He'd generally figure out where that get and dug a little hole there. And he hollered to me, I was 200 or 300 yards from him, and I started on over there. I heard him grunt. He could go there sometimes and grunt a few times, and a little alligator would pop up and shoot him. If you didn't, you had what we call a gator pool with a hook on it. You run down there and jug him 2 or 3 times, and part of the time he'd get mad enough to bite that hook, and then you'd pull him on out, and they would shoot him. So I was going on across as fast as I could. I kept hearing Henry grunt. And Rick Lauholler heard him walk. Damn son of a bitch. And I stopped. I said, what's the matter? He had miscalculated. He thought the gator's hole was here and it was back on. And he was grunting. He happened to look around and the gator was coming up on the nest back. He jumped up and cussed. He was always getting in a scrape. We was out there one day and I found one in this cave. I don't think it was during nesting then. And I whistled to him and
we're just